Welcome to Unraveling the Anthropocene, Race, Environment, and Pandemic, a podcast series brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective, or LAC, at the Pennsylvania State University. As an interdisciplinary group, we promote visionary scholarship in the humanities, we build community across different fields of study, and we highlight the ways that different disciplines inform and shape one another. You can find more information about our previous events on our website, sites.psu.edu/liberalartscollective. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic this year, we have developed this podcast series as an intervention into our global ecological emergency. In our discussions with scholars, activists, artists, and community members, we address how global ecological crises both impact and are impacted by political turmoil, widespread outbreaks of infectious disease, and racial violence.
Hi, and welcome back to Unraveling the Anthropocene. I'm Irene Agbedian, and in this episode, I'll be having a conversation with Dr. Tryon Woods on his scholarly research, which investigates police power, slavery, and the contemporary culture of politics. Dr. Woods teaches crime and justice studies at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and Black Studies at Providence College. He is the author of Black Hood Against the Police Power, Punishment and Disavowal in the Post-Racial Era, and the co-editor of Conceptual Aphasia in Black, Displacing Racial Formation, and co-editor of En Moyen-Âge, Ethical Confrontations with Anti-Blackness. He is also co-editor of the forthcoming book on contemporary African migration, Ex Aqua in the Mediterranean, Excavating Black Power in the Migrant Question. Dr. Woods has taught at a number of universities in New England and California, at prisons in New York City and the San Francisco Bay Area, and he has worked with community organizations in New York City, Seattle, and Oakland on HIV/AIDS prevention, supportive housing for drug users, and police accountability. Tryon, thank you for joining us on our series. I'm glad to be speaking with you today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So can you tell us some more about yourself and about the work that you do?
So I guess something I could, a little bio background I could add in terms of what you add to what you already said is that I started working after college in New York City doing HIV and AIDS prevention education. And I got into that not out of any particular inclination to public health per se, but because it was really, I could tell right away that it was one of these sort of crucibles, one of these places where all the different sort of factors and forces of society converge and are sort of laid bare or exposed. So I wanted to put myself in that mix to understand that better. Doing that, however, is where I kind of got exposed to the way that the criminal justice system, the law, policing, trips people up as they're trying to put their lives back together. People are trying to make changes in their life in terms of addiction or violence or criminal records, kept getting interfered with by the police and by the courts. And so I was like, well, what is this all about? And so that was one of the questions that prompted me to go back to school and study these connections and these histories that play out, whether it's in public health context or in the law a little bit further. So in that process, though, I came to learn that it's not the particular institutions that matter. It's really how we look at the institutions that allow us to make those connections. That's what really led me to commit and to invest in a Black Studies approach, because that's what I've learned to provide what is most essential to any question. It doesn't answer all the questions, but without that perspective, you're missing what's essential. So.
Thank you for giving us that expansion of your work and how, you know, your life experiences inform the direction you've taken your scholarly research. I want to ask, what is Black Hood and what is the Black Hood Project?
So Black Hood, the term comes from Tony K. Bambara, who was a major artist, writer, scholar, teacher, filmmaker, whose work straddles both the Black arts movement of the 1960s and 70s and the post-civil rights period of the 1980s, 2000s. And in 1970, she published a landmark volume called The Black Woman, which anthologized writings by and about Black women on a variety of issues. And one of her own essays in that volume was an essay called On the Issue of Roles, in which she addresses the question of gender roles within the Black movement and the matter of how to frame racial justice in terms of sexual justice and vice versa. So she was intervening on the debate that was internal to the Black community at the time, but actually framed and refracted from outside of it as to whether Black women's experiences with sex and gender-based violence somehow drag down the overall cause for racial equality or not. So Bambara rejects, in that essay, she rejected this either or dichotomy of how this debate is framed, and pointedly said, perhaps we need to let go of all notions of manhood and femininity and concentrate on Blackhood. So that's where she coins the term, and that's where I get it from. And I use her notion of Blackhood in a couple ways. First, I use it to reconnect contemporary critical thought to the revalorization of Blackness that was central to, not the singular contribution, but central to the Black Power era politics and its conjoined movements, Black Arts Movement and the Black Studies Movement. The Black Power era articulated not only an aesthetic, but a political analysis of Blackness as central to understanding the modern era. This politic was displaced, however, during the post-civil rights period and the post-COINTELPRO period, the Covert Intelligence Project of the FBI, and was taken over by multiculturalism, or what we now call diversity and equity, that have emerged to really sort of control the narrative about race. So thinking in terms of Blackness became discredited as sort of a retrograde essentialism. And we ended up with, instead of Black studies, African-American studies as one among many ethnic studies fields, each sort of set up to complement and mirror the Euro-American canon. So secondly, I use Blackhood then to draw attention to the Black non-Black framework as the operative color line, not white non-white. So the slave trade built the foundation of the modern world through anti-Black violence, not simply through white supremacy. So we know that anti-Blackness is more fundamental to our world than white supremacy for two reasons, at least. First, because since the human race is normatively white, racialized human beings exist as a non-white subspecies of humanity, with the negation of white being its supposed opposite, Black. And this is why, this is following off of the philosopher Lewis Gordon, who explains that in the anti-Black world, there is but one race, Black, and to be racialized is to be pushed down towards Blackness, while to be deracialized is to move up toward whiteness. And what this means then is that race is itself a product of racism, not the other way around. And this is a function of it is a function, therefore, of the dominance that white society claims for itself and expresses through the prerogative to explain the hierarchy created by such dominance in terms of racialization and names that society that it creates as natural. Secondly, we know that anti-Blackness is more fundamental because the ascendancy of non-Black people of color in all areas around the globe stands as a definitive discrediting of white supremacy. But we also see that this development doesn't destabilize anti-Blackness as the basic sort of organizing principle of modern humanity. So all non-Black people of color are always compelled at some level to distance themselves from Blackness, even as they reject the notion of white supremacy, at least in principle. And then third, I use Blackhood to update Bambara's original intent with the term. So today's equivalent of the debate that she was engaged with about the place of gender and sex in the Black movement would be intersectionality, or a queer of color critique, or Black feminism. Right. Bambara's Blackhood concept was a call to give up gender and redefine liberation in terms of Blackhood. So my use of Blackhood is meant to extend this move by calling attention to the fact that sexualities and gender concepts, constructs, are formulated, propounded, and theorized as race. Western civilization and its various codes of being human, such as gender, sexuality, citizen, labor, and so on, are all founded on a primary and sexually graphic opposition between Black and non-Black persons. If humanity is constructed through its negation, Blackness, then Black also stands in as the negation of every code through which we understand what it means to be human, gender, sex, and so on. So attempts to reconstruct the meaning of gender and sexuality then necessarily rely upon the normative codes of race, gender and sex, for example, and have to work within the normative framework of anti-Blackness, attempting to counter it from within, so to speak. So I use Black Hood, I try to extend Bambara's use of Black Hood and update it in this way to show some of the limits to the strategy and also to point out up some of the ways in which Black liberation may need to come through a more fundamental rejection of Western thought and practice, which many thinkers are arguing with respect to certain institutional forces like the law perhaps, but are reluctant to do so with respect to the body's categories like gender and sexuality.
Thank you for such an extensive answer. So the way you're using this term taps into a history of Black art, expression, the place of gender in liberation struggles. It recovers this extensive intellectual and theoretical history, and it highlights these deep theoretical connections. And for you, you're extending Gambara's original use of the word into this space where you can make all these new connections, where you can establish these projects that seek to nuance what we understand about Blackness, about anti-Blackness really as well. So that's a lot in one word and in one project. I want to shift our conversation towards your book. So key to your argument in your book, Black Hood Against the Police Power, Punishment and Disavowal in the Post-Racial Era, is an understanding of spectacles of state violence. For you, these spectacles are indicative of a baseline police power that constructs society. Help me break this down. What are these quote unquote spectacles of state violence? And what do you mean that police power shapes society?
Yeah, so that's a good way of putting it, that state violence is, as you said, is indicative of a baseline police power. Yeah, so that's exactly what I'm trying to get at. But the key, or at least what I'm trying to demonstrate in the work, is that how we read that is really critical. We have to read it in a particular way. The problem with the spectacle is that it becomes hypervisible, right? So it becomes a hypervisible construction of the police power, which, like the spotlight on a stage, hides as much as it reveals. The criminal justice system is really enough of a problem that you could spend your life studying it and challenging it alone on its terms, as people have done. And many people have sacrificed themselves to do just that. And it's on their on the backs of their struggle that we have much more understanding of what's really going on. But because many people are doing that important work in this regard, and because I've always found, for me anyway, that the kind of thinking that is most useful for me is where we are able to make connections between things that may not at first appear connected. I think that I try to make my contribution, my modest contribution, is trying to situate police and prisons within the structure that produces them. So I'm really only interested in analyzing the law and the criminal justice apparatus as long as it gives us points us in the right direction to a deeper cut on the structures of power that are really shaping society in general. The way I talk about it with my students, for example, is law enforcement only has power situationally. Otherwise, it simply represents the structure of power. It's like an appendage of power, like the arm connected to the body, right? It's symptomatic of the structure of the police power of civil society itself. Similarly, the law also is symptomatic of the police power of civil society. So law and criminal justice can be diagnostic tools at best, but only if we read them in the right direction. So thinking it through historically is key. Some people point to, when they say, well, where does modern policing come from? They point to the slave patrols, right? And this is key for thinking of the sort of antecedents to modern law enforcement. And at least this gets us thinking about slavery, but it is also somewhat misleading because the police power of slaveholding culture rested not in a discrete unit that was deputized to police fugitive slaves, it rested in every white person's hands, right? So it was the right and duty of every white person to police and punish every Black person. And this went on for over five centuries, until the civil rights era forced it out of the hands of everyday white folk and into the purview of the state. So it's only really been in the hands of the state for barely 50 years, which on the one hand should really explain at first blush why the state is so clumsy in its use of it, but secondly also remind us that it's not really theirs, right? It's only on loan to the state, or it's only been extended to the state. The state's only standing in for the police power of the society writ large. So what is the police power then if it's not reducible to the police and the prisons. The broadest way I conceive of it is it's a socio-historical process of implementing and reproducing the modern world's onto epistemic structure of Blackness, what it means to exist in the world and the knowledge that we create about that existence. So the culture of politics, right, the term you used in the intro, by which I mean sort of a cultural paradigm within which we understand and inhabit and contest power, serves as the principal mode of policing in the anti-Black world. Right? It literally is a cultural problem, not a institutional or individual problem. And by anti-Blackness, I mean the position of Blackness stands as the antithesis of what it means to be human culturally. It's the most despised position as such. It is that which orients all other positions within the culture. So all the ethical dilemmas that matter to modern society then take their standing, take their orientation against Blackness. So what it means to be democratic, for example, what it means to have a democracy, requires implicitly the violent subjugation of Black people. And we see this throughout every historical era in the United States. The police power then precedes law, it comes first, and it precedes capital, because it's produced through Western civilization's conception of the autonomous individual, unfettered by external constraints and empowered to possess not only him or herself, but also dispossess other beings. Right, the example of, I could pull up any number of examples, but I think the one that I use a lot is from Ferguson, right, the killing of Michael Brown a few years ago, when Officer Darren Wilson shot Michael Brown. The tendency is to see the incident simply as one in which a police officer acted wrongly or prejudicially, and then was backed up by key prejudicial actors in the legal system. And that's not incorrect, but we can also read it in terms of the structural necessity for this anti-Black violence. In other words, as an indication of how the system is oriented rather than the system's breakdown or glitch. So Wilson's killing of Brown then was foremost an act of anti-Black violence, the after effect of which, the outcome of that violence, is the meaning of race. So the violence literally constructs the meaning of race, Brown's dead body and Wilson's unaccountable white one. Or leaving Brown's dead body lying in the middle of the street, as the police did, uncovered for 4 hours, was an act of anti-Black violence. The after effect of that violence, again, constructs the meaning of race. In this case, the Black community left to witness its own social death. So that's sort of what I mean by the police power of civil society, and we can read it through the law in its operations as long as we travel in the right direction, as long as we use it as a way of diagnosing how the structure, the body of the society works, rather than just simply in its appendages.
You've given us a lot of directions to go in, from looking at this very public display of Black pain, of Black suffering, of crimes committed against the Black body, to this connection that police power, modern police power in the United States especially, has to a history of slavery. So I kind of want to ask a question about that one. In the description of your projects, you mentioned that, quote, the goal is to uncover the inner workings of humanism in order to better name how slaveholding culture functions today when nobody is legally held in bondage, slavery without slaves, end quote. I want to ask, and you've kind of started to explain this question or respond to it, how does slavery continue to function and continue to structure contemporary society and politics?
Okay, yeah, that is the question. And there's that can keep us going for a long time. But I think that, let me make a contrast as a way of sort of illustrating or getting at that question. One is the most common way we hear slavery evoked today is with respect to mass incarceration. And we now have the term that's used a lot called the afterlife of slavery, right? Which is meant to connote that slavery as an institution is not over, but it lives on in other forms. And the forms that are identifiable are ones where Black people are locked up or are forced to work in the fields, sometimes the very same fields that were plantations that their ancestors were enslaved on, right? And examples in the South, in the prison farms in the South evoke that. This is certainly true, but it's only part of the issue. And this is why I'm emphasizing the police power of civil society as the outgrowth or an expression of slaveholding culture, so that we are not simply looking at the obvious visual accoutrements of enslaved or chattel conditions, right? So the prison is an obvious connection to the chattel condition. When people contest mass incarceration on those grounds, oftentimes they point to the 13th Amendment. People are increasingly more aware that the 13th Amendment didn't abolish slavery at all. It simply remanded it to the purview of the criminal justice system. So you can use slavery as long as a person has been convicted of a crime. So penal servitude was instituted as it was, as servitude writ large was abolished in its prior instantiations, right? So the 13th Amendment created penal servitude. So commentators, and there was a prominent documentary called The 13th that Ava DuVernay, the filmmaker, created a few years back, that makes this, centered around this very argument, that the 13th clause in the 13th Amendment is a loophole, right? And when we call something a loophole, what we're saying is that it was a mistake. We forgot to close the back door behind us, and we let in some ill-mannered folks or some people who have malicious intents. And they've created this, they've exploited this loophole to create slavery in a new form. But this is not correct, and it's not faithful to Black historical struggle. And the reason why, and we just simply need to study W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction to learn this, he says in that important work that the purpose of the Civil War was never to end slavery. It was to preserve slavery's place in the Union, right? So the North was as committed to keeping slavery as the South was. Lincoln went around reassuring folks, leaders both North and South, that the slaves would be returned, slaveholders would be compensated, they'd be paid restitution, they'd lose their property. So the war to preserve slavery was really just a conflict within slaveholding culture, within the slaveholding class. And it was the slaves themselves, Du Bois explains, that forced the issue to be one of emancipation, right? And he basically argues that the slaves freed themselves by insisting, by withholding their labor from the plantations, by going to the North, by following the Northern Army around, making it a war to end slavery. So it made it impossible not to do that. But that history is critical because when we look at what comes afterwards, we see that the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, are not the outgrowth of an abolitionist desire to correct the wrongs of slavery. They are rather an attempt to redesign what was never meant to be given up in the first place. And so the 13th Amendment is not the clause in the 13th Amendment of penal servitude is not a loophole. It's a design feature. It's not a flaw. And what it says is that not only can convicts become enslaved, so not only are we looking towards the prison system to see the remnants or the carryover, the holdover of slavery, but criminalization is a political symbolic tool. In other words, it's the construct that society creates through its structures of power. It is not a reflection of individual behaviors. It is not the outcome of wrongdoing or anything that the individual does. It is a political symbolic tool. It reflects power. What this means is that criminalization is already in effect before there's a prison, before there's a law, before there's policing, i.e. before there's the 13th Amendment. So when the 13th Amendment says that convicts can be enslaved, what it's saying is that all the people that have already been construed as beyond the pale of the law, inherently criminal, inherently violent, the threat to the internal domestic enemies to society, i.e. Black people, can be enslaved. So what the 13th Amendment does then is it socializes slavery. It socializes the slave condition without actually requiring anybody to be legally held as a slave, which is what the legal scholar Goyora Bender, how he puts it. So that's sort of the reinterpretation that I try to promote that is faithful to Black history and Black historical struggle, and then gets us out of thinking through the state's own narratives, because the state wants us to think about the question of slavery through the law. Well, slavery is illegal, so how could there be slavery? Well, slavery never required the law. Slavery was prior to the law. The law follows slavery. And this is one example of what we mean by that. So slavery is a socialized condition that doesn't require any legal apparatus to enforce that, whether it's the criminal justice system or not.
Wow. Thank you for that very extensive answer. So we can see that slavery and its afterlives, you know, its after effects, it's threaded through our legal language. It's in our prison system. It's in this process of criminalization. So even though the practice itself formally no longer exists, in the way that it was originally constructed, it's very much alive and active in constructing the way that people are able to think and exist and move in the United States, particularly people of color, particularly Black bodies. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for giving us that historical and theoretical perspective. I want to shift this back a little bit towards policing and the criminal justice system. So, you know, some of us hear police and we think about the criminal justice system as the main realm in which the police work. What are other areas of society that are affected by or shaped by police power?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the short answer is there really isn't any area of society that's not affected or shaped by the police power of anti-Black violence. And that's partly what I was indicating when I said that criminalization is a socialized condition. It's the product of the political symbolic, it's a political symbolic tool that society uses, and it uses it everywhere, right? So it uses to say who's eligible for housing, who's eligible to be employed, you know, and so on and so forth. So that's why, as I mentioned in the outset, Black studies is indispensable to all studies. This is not because, as we said, that it answers every question that we should be asking, but without it, you'll leave out what's essential about the world, which is that it's yoked to this material and symbolic violence against Blackness. So by enforcing anti-Blackness, then the police power reproduces this culture of slaveholding that we've been talking about. So every institution is structured by this reality. The criminal justice system, again, is not a failure because the principles of fairness are not applied equally, right? All the disproportionate impact that we can track throughout every stage of the system, this is not a failure in the system, this is by design. But we also have to extend this analysis or apply this analysis throughout all of society. So medical science is not failing because there are health inequities by race and class. That's a design feature, not a flaw in the system. The same inequities, of course, have been tracked persistently in housing and labor markets, amounting almost to a reversal in the intergenerational wealth transfer, right? So each subsequent Black generation is robbed of what little was bequeathed as ancestors and further exposed then to all sort of the complexities of toxic environments and insecurities, housing insecurities, labor insecurities, so forth. The foreclosure crisis in 2008 that disproportionately impacted Black families, Black homeowners, was really a repeat of what happened in earlier generations in the 60s and 70s and before. So, I mean, we can point to all these different areas. I mean, social media is probably the most insidious industry of the police power today, but it's not a new one. It's just new in its technology. So we willingly submit now to mass surveillance and allow corporations to extract information about our personal experience and turn it into predictive behavioral data that's sold to other corporations that use it to further shape our consumptive tastes and behaviors and human connection. All of this, though, is continuous with the original biometric data produced by slavery's construction of a race, biology, behavior nexus, right? So the early biometric data comes out of the slave trade and slavery, the marking of slaves, the lantern laws that required slaves to carry certain lighting with them when they moved through society and so on and so forth. So we can continue running down each institution, each industry, each sector of society in this way, but this is what we mean by the police power in effect. The material realities that produce disproportionate suffering and premature death for Blacks versus non-Black people, but also in the discursive realm where the problem of inequality is routinely misrecognized as a procedural failure whether it's in unfairly operated systems or in prejudicial individuals, right? So we can really apply it in this comprehensive way, because it wouldn't work from the point of view of anti-Blackness, from the point of view of slaveholding culture. It wouldn't work if it were really just relegated to one discrete industry or one discrete institution in society.
So police power and policing in general is just so pervasive. It exists in every possible realm that we can think of. How is it that policing manages to mask itself to not appear as such?
Yes, this is key. And as others before me have pointed out, right, this is how power is most effective, right? It's most effective where it goes unnamed or misrecognized as such. And policing is a good example of this. One of the most effective ways that the police power operates without appearing to be operating is for anti-Blackness to masquerade as anti-racism. So there's some examples of this. The current bipartisan coalition to end mass incarceration through sentencing reform, it's gotten a little bit more attention these days. And so you've got people on both the right and the left, Republicans and Democrats, supporting sentencing reform, supporting letting nonviolent offenders, particularly nonviolent drug offenders, out, alternatives to incarceration, things like that. This is all fine and well, and this is absolutely necessary, but it relies upon the racial stereotyping of violence as Black and of Black people as inherently violent to express this preference for nonviolent offenders. Right? So there's a racial dichotomy in violence and nonviolence that's implicit in this discussion about sentencing reform. Another example is in terms of madness. Right? Black artists in particular are smeared with this stain of being crazy or having mental health problems. From Nina Simone to Lauryn Hill, it's not just simply the cliche that the line between genius and insanity is a blurred one, right? We often hear that evoked. But for Black artists in particular, it's political. And in the Black Hood book, I start to talk about the documentary work of filmmaker Liz Garbus. And in my forthcoming film book, I spend much more time looking at her whole body of work. But in the Black Hood book, I start with her film about Nina Simone, which was released on Netflix a few years back. I think it was called What Happened, Miss Simone? And Garbus has credentials of being a feminist and doing films that treat Black subjects with sensitivity, including films on incarceration, the death penalty, adolescent girls. But in the film about Nina Simone, she presents Nina Simone as an artist who lost her way. And she lost her way because she succumbed to her internal demons, right? Her mental illness struggle. But in presenting that portrait, she has to suppress Nina Simone's own analysis about the racism in US society and what it does to people, and particularly what it does to Black celebrities. And she had to suppress her own resistance to that racism, both at home, right, against her husband who was abusing her and raping her. Right? And Garbus doesn't treat that at all. In fact, she interviews her husband as if he's sort of a legitimate source of information about the person that he's victimizing. And she treats the people who then later on sort of come to Nina Simone's rescue, as it were, by medicating her and making her manageable, right? And so this is a very problematic treatment of Blackness as something that has to be controlled, but appears to be a sensitive portrait of a complicated artist. It internalizes the social problems of the world, makes her analysis look like the rantings of a lunatic, when in fact it's completely consistent not only with what the Black movement was advocating at the time and expressing at the time, but also what others deemed absolutely necessary in order to get by and make change in the world.
So a couple of the examples you've named, whether intentionally or unintentionally, they're tapping into these discourses of anti-Blackness as they're attempting to do, you know, good social work. So for example, the documentary you named, looking at the immigrant rights reform movement, not saying that they're literally going out of their way to demonize, criminalize.
No, not at all.
But they're tapping into this conversation.
And that's part of the point, is that you don't have to go out of your way because it's readily available. In fact, most people, in the examples that we use, all those examples and many more besides are anti-racist and are very much intending to make positive change. But the tropes of anti-Blackness and the point of the position of anti-Blackness is the point of reference for even remedying the harms or the problems or the failures in American democratic society. And that's why inevitably it often comes in unless we're conscious about how to not do that.
So you would say that in reform movements, there needs to be a more conscientious effort to examine or adapt the discourses that are being used to demand change, ones that look more explicitly at the ways that police power, that state violence have subconsciously constructed our approaches to any type of transformation based on racial justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I want to shift our conversation a little bit more towards the pandemic. Obviously, it's still one of the major things that's anchoring our society, or rather anchoring, maybe dismantling in a lot of ways, our society. So in your opinion, what has the pandemic made visible or clarified about policing and police power, and how has the pandemic done that?
Okay, yeah. So this is the crux of the matter right now, obviously, as you said. And the understanding of the police power that we've been talking about, which is, as we said, derived from the insights of Black thought and Black historical struggle. So it's not, it's based on a longstanding confrontation with power that is unbroken and unruptured despite the narratives to the contrary from US history. So it's a form of structural analysis then that allows us to question state narratives, allows us to make connections across different areas of society, allows us to think politically about the production of common sense, which means, right, to think about common sense as an expression itself of power, allows us to track the money and identify, as we were just referring to, how anti-racism can still mean anti-Blackness, and in general, just think independently and critically. And when the pandemic began, I saw the police power in full effect, dressed up as public health protocols and medical science. And from the perspective of Black historical struggle, the starting point is that it's treacherous, frankly, to call for more and better care from the state. It doesn't mean that you don't do it, but it is a very treacherous position to take. So the state's existence is to reproduce the very systemic inequities that we are seeing laid bare. So why would we call for the state to do more? That would mean more suffering, not less. Right. This is why the Black movement has consistently produced a police prison abolitionist discourse to deal with the criminal justice system. Because at every historical juncture, it was liberal reforms, right, well-meaning reforms that were created to remedy the excesses in policing, in punishment, in violence of prior periods that have then had the effect each time of leaving us with a stronger, more expansive, more deeply entrenched system of policing and punishment that today directly controls over 7 million people and indirectly polices the lives of the untold millions of people connected to each of those 7 million, right? Because one person controlled by the state, whether it's through incarceration, parole, or probation, right? That's the 7 million, is always connected to 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 other people, right? We're not isolated, we don't live in vacuums. In New York City, the notorious Rikers Island jail complex it's now finally scheduled to be closed, but the plan includes replacing it with a geographically dispersed set of 4 jails situated in different boroughs. So it's not the building that makes the jail inhumane, right? You close that building because that was a mess, and you open this other one, it's gonna be different. It's the inhumanity of caging people. And when people organized against the use of solitary confinement of minors, of the youth at Rikers, all the jail did was simply chain youth in place to tables in the common areas. So the way in which the pandemic police power is working on us now is that the hard-earned lessons of anti-prison, anti-police organizing, which have really always been central when they're not, even when they weren't called those things, always been central to the Black liberation movement, they're not being transferred into these other areas of society, such as the medical science industrial complex. This is odd because there are longstanding ways in which the two have been conjoined from the start. So medicine conducted experiments on slaves to advance science. They continued these experiments after emancipation on Black sharecroppers, convicts, and everyday Black folks. The notorious Tuskegee syphilis experiment is not the only example of this to infiltrate mainstream consciousness. There was the case of Henrietta Lacks that got a lot of attention recently. Experiments at Philadelphia's Holmesburg Prison, radiation experiments in Black cancer patients. These are just the name, but a handful of the best documented cases. We can point to the way the CDC recently handled the water contamination crises in Flint, and before that in Washington, DC, just to offer more evidence of how the state's public health establishment today does not act in the interests of the people. So when people talk today about how to convince Black people and others to trust the government and take the vaccine, it's really the most blatant form of anti-Black racism, because it acts as if there's no valid reason to question the state's consistently horrific treatment of Black people throughout time. So not only is it eminently rational and reasonable to question the state's narrative on public health, but all the necessary information is out there in the public record. You just need to ask questions, make connections, and not allow state power to mystify the evidence. COVID-19 is simply intensifying and thus laying bare how the police power also works through public health.
But then I wonder, you know, in casual conversations and for people outside of, not to set up that divide between academia and non-academia, but I'm just wondering, like, how are we supposed to be able to get a critical mass to interrogate state power when perhaps it's not the way that most people are trained to interact with information or have a vested interest in doing, because there are other concerns for them, you know?
Well, let's be real, there's costs. I mean, that's
there's
lots of costs, particularly now. And we see how serious those costs are by simply gauging how rigorous the attempt to quell sort of dissent is. Right, the fact that media outlets of all kinds come out with these fact checker things, like, okay, so now you're telling me you're talking about the facts. I mean, that's a clear sign. It's like a like putting a big old red flag. Okay, yeah, we're talking about an ideological practice. Whether or not there's facts involved is sort of secondary, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they're not facts involved, but there's a lot of pressure to go along. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of serious pressure. And for students and for young people in particular, it's very intense. I mean, you have to go along with vaccinations. You have to go along with all the distancing. Young people are being blamed for transmitting the disease to their beloved elders. I mean, there's all sorts of pressure that we should be reading critically. We don't throw out any information. We look at everything and evaluate it on its own merits. But this fact that there's so much pressure to quell dissent really screams out for more critical attention about why that is. What is being covered? What is being protected? What are we being sort of distracted or encouraged not to look at for what it is?
I'll pivot us back to kind of the formal questions that I have for the interview, picking up, and hopefully we'll be able to pick up on that idea in this question. So, in your article, Confronting Pandemic Police Powers, you open with the line, yes, this virus discriminates. My question is how?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I think that the manner of COVID-19's discriminatory impacts, right, is, and by that I mean it is inclusive of the effects of lockdown itself, not just illness and death. But the effects, the discriminatory impacts, have been pretty well covered through the media landscape and on your podcast series too. I think most recently, I heard Nancy Tuana talk about her climate apartheid project in episode 13 or 14. And then it was mentioned in a few other episodes as well. So we see clearly that the health outcomes of people of color and the poor and working classes is worse is just having a disproportionate impact on people of color and the workers than it is on whites and the wealthy, right? That's very clear. This is the police power at work. Healthy lives are socially produced, and social processes are themselves expressions of group-based power. So that's why health is predicated on social status, not simply on individual choice and behavior. Now, public health discourse, of course, calls this comorbidities, but that's just simply the perfect example of what we're talking about there, because these comorbidities are socially produced through unhealthy environments. But I think in terms of our analysis of the police power, and given what we were just talking about a second ago, we need to go further than identify the ways that health outcomes are produced through racism. Because that's like saying Black people are disproportionately incarcerated, or Black people are subjected to racial profiling by the police and white people are not. This is all true. And this is the sort of necessary step or the point of departure for a deeper analysis. But the same thing with public health, we can't stop there. So I would think of particular interest then for your discussions on the Anthropocene would be issues like gain of function research, xenotransplantation, zoonotic diseases, retroviruses, right? These kinds of things, because these all exist. These are all the creation of medical science, and they're the way in which a particular kind of humanity has impacted the natural world in a way that is producing serious consequences. So it's not that we need to point to the actual source of the COVID-19 or to question the possibility of making an effective vaccine, but it's simply to understand and know the role of the state in that process, as well in the broader sense, right? And this is the concern with the Anthropocene. In the broader sense, how are we, through medical science and modern industry, using nature in a way that may have unintended problematic outcomes that we're not really aware of or we're not talking about, and information about which is being kept from us?
So again, there's this need to make informed decisions about what is happening around us, what is happening to us, right? Yeah. To find ways of navigating in this world. So there is a burden that comes on us to, you know, get Absolutely. More information. I want to ask another question, kind of more about terminology. So when talking about your work in relation to the Anthropocene, you mentioned the term racial capitalocene. Can you break this down for us? What does this term do that Anthropocene doesn't?
Yeah, so this isn't my term, but I encountered this, encountered its use among scholars who work within this discourse of racial capitalism. So racial capitalism is usually taken by its proponents to be a more accurate descriptor of the global capitalist system. So they explain that capitalism has always relied upon racialization, creating of differences, and as such, race continues to be central to its operations. And they point to Cedric Robinson as the originator of this concept in his 1981 book called Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition. Now, I position my work as a sort of friendly amendment to racial capitalism discourse. I don't think the concept and how its proponents make use of it is specific enough, nor historically precise with respect to capitalism's origins in the racism of Western civilization, which I think is one of Robertson's, at least according to my reading, one of his main arguments in Black Marxism. But what I think racial capitalocene does that's useful is that I think it makes a modest intervention on the Anthropocene, in that it potentially exposes the universalizing tendency of Anthropocene discourse. The impression is that the era of human beings' impact on the natural world is universal, and this connects with Western humanism's conception of man and human in ethnocentric but universalist terms. But since these are ethnocentric concepts, right, man and human, racial capitalocene potentially exposes how the Anthropocene concept risks reproducing the very colonizing effect that it purportedly aims to reveal. Think about it like Sylvia Winter puts it. She says that we need to particularize man, capital M, man. And for the racial capitalocene intervention, this might mean locating the global changes wrought since the dawn of the slave trade at the feet of one particular conception of human being, Western Euro-American culture, not all of humanity. So in this sense, climate change is not the product of human activity. It's the result of the activities of a culturally specific version of humanity, right? So the Maasai in Kenya or the Lakota in North America have had nothing to do with that. So even as this Western conception of humanity then becomes increasingly globalized and people of all different cultures become interpolated into its homogenizing and world degrading processes, it's still important, I think, to distinguish that it is a culturally and historically specific process, specific to the slave trading culture of the West. So I think racial capitalism connects well with what some people are talking about in Anthropocene in terms of environmental degradation not being inevitable, with other ways of being human on the earth that are not intrinsically consumptive and exploitative, and so on. So I mean, as I'm not by any means an expert in Anthropocene discourse, but as I track some of your discussions in this series, I think racial capitalism connects with the understanding that a number of people have put out there that racism is constitutive to the processes of capital accumulation that degrade the world's ecosystems, and with also the converse of that, which is that the world's downward trajectory will not be undone without making anti-racism central to our plans.
Absolutely. And I mean, from the beginning of our series, one of the questions that we had was interrogating this term Anthropocene itself and understanding that it's a specifically located, culturally, historically informed term that perhaps elides some of the nuances that terms like racial capitalism will reintroduce. Mm-hmm. Thank you for giving us that expansion. Mm-hmm. Let's shift a bit more towards books, right? Books, research, what we're doing, right? We're mm-hmm. academics here. So you're working on two new books now, one on viral video recordings of anti-Black violence in the context of the way Hollywood, independent films, and documentaries treat Black subjects. The other book focuses on humanitarianism and racial capitalism in the context of African migrations across the Mediterranean. You're also working on a law review article called Where It Is Least Visible, Public Health Policing. You're doing a lot. How are these projects going, and can you tell us more about them?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for that. The law review, everything got put on hold for the law review article, which will be out this spring, because I wanted to, I mean, since the pandemic started, it was impossible not to do, I just got pulled into doing research on that. And at first it was hard to write anything about it because there was no place to put it. Nobody would touch any of this research that, you know, that is out there. You have to, In fact, the confronting pandemic police power article that you referred to, that Abolition Journal put out, a version of that was rejected by a whole slew of what I thought were sort of progressive political sites, you know, in that one doesn't make the kinds of claims that I actually just made, you know, today in our conversation about, you know, sort of origins and gain of function research and, you know, questioning the political construct of pandemics, like all that stuff that we've kind of broached as a topic that people should explore further. Wasn't even in that piece, but it proved too hot to handle at the time. And so the opportunity to write a law review article on policing really compelled me to apply this analysis of the police power to the pandemic situation. So that some of what we've been talking about will be in that forthcoming article. The other pieces are the film book is largely done, but it's been sitting there waiting for a time to write that key chapter that it's missing. Part of that work came out of is material that did not fit into the Black Hood book, the first Black Hood book. And so that's where I extend my analysis of Liz Garbus's documentary work and show how what she produced, what I really consider to be a pretty grotesque anti-Black treatment of Nina Simone in her documentary. I track her work backwards in some other films. A film about the farm, Angola State Prison, Louisiana, a film about a death row inmate, a film about some adolescent girls. And to show that this her treatment of her Black subjects has been working this angle for quite some time. And I think what's unique about this, I'm hoping what's unique about this book is that I take two things that have gotten a lot of attention in their own right. So cinema has gotten obviously a lot of attention, and particularly images of Blackness on film have rightfully gotten a lot of very useful critical attention. And then on the other hand, the scrutiny of the viral videos, as they're called, of police killings and other forms of anti-Black violence, right, have also gotten a lot more, not just attention, right? People, they get a lot of attention, right? That's the term, the viral video, but they've gotten a lot more critical attention recently. But I think what I'm trying to do here that might be useful is bringing those two things together. And what that allows me to do is to make the case that the exposure of police, of state violence through these viral videos has more entertainment value than it does pedagogical value. In other words, it's much more useful to reaffirm and retrench the status quo than it is to galvanize change. This is not a very optimistic analysis, but I think it's consistent with what we see in cinema and of all kinds. And so I'm not just looking at Hollywood cinema, but I'm also looking at documentary film as well as independent Black cinema, whether it's Spike Lee or Haile Gerima, some well-regarded Black filmmakers who the images of Blackness and particularly of Black sexuality that they rely upon are actually very consistent with, not opposed to, some of the images that are circulating through the viral videos of state violence. So I'm hoping that that's a provocative comparison and a provocative dialogue. The other book, which is gonna come out before this film one, so the film one is third in line, unfortunately, but after the Law Review article is done and after this book that I'm working on with my good friend and colleague, Khalil Saucier at Bucknell University, near where you are, we're writing about African migrations across the Mediterranean, as you said. And our interest here is not so much empirical or sociological, but to interrogate the humanitarian discourses and the sort of massaging of law and order discourses that the nation state uses to raise alarm about Black death in the Mediterranean, but also to shore up its own national identities in the process. So we're drawing upon sort of histories of abolitionism to show that the abolitionist movements across different eras, right? And today it's this abolitionism of modern day slavery discourse, that abolitionism has never really been about remedying power. It's really been about reorganizing and extending it in new terms. And so how does that play out in this contemporary crisis, which really should galvanize much more attention than it has been? So that's where those are at. And hopefully the Mediterranean book will be out this year, 2021, at least it'll be done this year. And then hopefully the film book next year.
Well, I'm looking forward to those, especially the film book, despite the somewhat pessimistic outlook it has. It sounds fascinating, and it particularly resonates with my own research on film and representations of Blackness. But all this work sounds amazing. Just a personal question for you. How has the pandemic changed your work practices? I mean, you're putting out a lot of things and investigating all these fascinating projects, but how has the pandemic impacted you?
Yes. So that's, I guess the short answer is that it actually hasn't impacted me all that much, to be honest. My professional work, that is. I've had to, in some ways, redirect my energies into my scholarship as opposed to into sort of more in the institution itself, if I'll leave it at that. And that's made this period be pretty seamless for me in that sense. And so it's really more how it's impacted me as a father and a teacher that really has been so hard. And so the teaching that we do is just, technology is not a substitute for human relationships, as you know. And so teaching through these mediated environments is a poor substitute. So I'm hoping that I try to recreate the classroom as much as I can through the Zoom classrooms. In other words, I still insist on the same kind of participatory engaged exchange, but it's, you know, it's not, it doesn't work that great comparatively. So in that way, it's really taken a hit. And that's what's really been most upsetting to me, is what we're doing to education, because that means we're really really doing a number on the young people, and that's going to play out in the long run.
Yeah, it's been definitely a strange experience, and my heart goes out to anyone that's teaching or taking classes at this time.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing, an unbelievable thing that they're being asked to do.
Yeah.
Are there any particular texts, so books, articles, multimedia, that you'd recommend for our audience to learn more about police power, state violence, or literally anything we've discussed today?
I think the most important thing is how we do our reading, not so much what we read, but sometimes what we read can really open that portal to a new way of looking at things. So I would recommend anything in the Black Studies Archive, anything in the Black Studies Library, particularly Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. When I was introduced to that text in grad school, it really spun my world a little bit. And I teach it every year in my class. I find a way to work it into my class every year for that reason. Tony K. Bambara's book, Those Bones Are Not My Child, which is a novel about the Atlanta child murders in 1979, 1981, which she lived through herself. And I write about her book and her interpretation in my Black Hood book. But that novel, which she had to write as a novel, as a fictional account, because she felt that it was unsafe for her to write a nonfiction account. It was too hot to touch. And that's really a lesson for what's going on right now. But she really gives an exhaustive compendium of how the Black struggle is dealing with the Anthropocene, to use the term of your series. It really covers the gamut of environmental justice movements, gentrification in Black communities, and a whole host of other things. So I would say those two things, and then really anything that is on the do not read list with respect to medical science, you should read it. You should read it and check it out for yourself. Question everything and follow nothing.
So question, read, do your research.
That's right. Do your research. Do your work. Put in the work.
Thank you so much for contributing your time and energy, and for the fascinating work that you're doing. This has been a very provocative conversation, and I'm energized to do more work. So I just want to say thank you so much for joining us on our series and spending some time with me this morning, talking with me about all these issues. This has been Unraveling the Anthropocene, and for my audience, I'll see you again next time. Unraveling the Anthropocene is brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective at Penn State. This series was made possible by sponsorships from the University Park Allocation Committee, the Department of Comparative Literature, the Department of Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese, the Rock Ethics Institute, the Humanities Institute, and the Center for Global Studies. We at LAC thank you for your support. This episode was produced by Irene Agbidion. Be sure to subscribe and follow along wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Unraveling the Anthropocene project is getting bigger. During the spring and summer of 2021, we will be running a reading group to discuss the topics of race, environment, and pandemic. To join, visit our website or search Unraveling the Anthropocene on Goodreads.com. See you there.